Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. For the next hour, we will be discussing topics related to women's health. This year, the American Cancer Society predicts over 12,000 new cases of cervical cancer, over 50,000 new cases of uterine cancer, and in 2010 reported nearly 20,000 cases of ovarian cancer. You know, since cigarette smoking is still a serious public health problem, lung cancer remains the number one cancer-related death in women. But breast cancer is number two, with nearly 300,000 cases of breast cancer diagnosed every year. These are some of the women's health topics we will discuss tonight here on Red River Radio Health Matters. As always, we invite your questions. Please call us at 1-800-552-8555. Or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Joining us tonight, we welcome Dr. Destin Black, a surgical gynecologic oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Health System and University Health. Dr. Julie Mook, surgical breast specialist with Breast Care Specialist in Shreveport. And Dr. Katie Walton, a rheumatologist with the Highland Clinic here in Shreveport. Again, we welcome you to join our discussion. Please call us at 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Black, thank you for joining us on Health Matters once again. What are the recommendations for early detection of gynecological cancers?
So the main gynecologic cancers that we the most common types are endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, and cervical cancer. And the recommendations for screening of these cancers include annual pelvic exam with your physician. For cervical cancer, the main test that we perform is a pap smear, and also more recently the test for the human papillomavirus. And these tests should be started at the age of 21. At the age of 21, you should begin to have a pap smear performed regularly. And after the age of 29, we actually do what's called co-testing, where we actually check for the virus, the human papillomavirus, in conjunction with a pap smear. Now, many women think that by having this test performed, that this is also checking for ovarian cancer or uterine cancer. And it's important to remember that this test is really for cervical cancer and does not screen for ovarian cancer nor uterine cancer, which are the two other common gynecologic malignancies that we see. So women with uterine cancer and ovarian cancer, we actually don't have a screening tool for these cancers. And what we rely on really are symptoms. With ovarian cancer, which is less common but actually much more deadly, these women will have symptoms of pelvic pain, pressure, bloating, difficulty with urination. And when women have these symptoms, it's very important for them to tell their physician about these symptoms, especially if they persist for 2 weeks and don't improve. Uterine cancer usually present with symptoms with like bleeding, heavy bleeding after you've gone through menopause, and that's very, very important to present to your physician with these symptoms right away.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mook, thank you for joining us on Health Matters tonight. Breast cancer surveillance has been a controversial topic in the past few years. What are the current recommendations for breast cancer screening?
The current recommendations depend a little bit on the family history. For the average woman with not a very significant family history, we still recommend the first mammogram at age 40 and to have them annually or every year after that. If there's young breast cancers in the family or a more significant family history, it may be someone who needs increased screening, and those people should be evaluated by their physicians to see if they should be starting earlier or having something other than mammograms yearly.
Dr. Walton, thank you so much for joining us on Health Matters tonight. You know, osteoporosis causes over 1.5 million fractures every year, and at least one out of two women will experience a fracture due to osteoporosis during their lifetime. You know, actually, a woman's risk of breaking a hip due to osteoporosis is greater than a risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and uterine cancer combined. What are the current recommendations to screen for osteoporosis?
So again, like the previous disorders that were mentioned, there are some standard guidelines for a woman who does not have high risk factors, and I'll touch on those in just a little bit. It's recommended that she have a bone density test at age 65 in postmenopausal women. And although women are the focus of tonight's discussion, men should also be screened at age 70. Women who have risk factors or men who have risk factors, including cigarette smoking, heavy alcohol use, use glucocorticoids or other medications that would decrease bone density, those patients should have earlier screening. And that really should be discussed with the physician and sort of based on an individual basis.
Okay, thank you very much. We actually have a question submitted via internet before the show. Dr. Black, if someone has had ThermaChoice uterine ablation 3 years ago and it worked for about 2 years, but now menstruation is becoming heavier each month and lasting longer, can that procedure be repeated? And if not, what are some of the other options for that individual besides hysterectomy, which is the removal of the uterus?
Well, ThermaChoice actually destroys the lining of the inside of the uterus, so the endometrial lining, and it is a good treatment for patients that are candidates that have heavy menstrual cycles. It's not always effective, and it in my I don't. This is not a test that I perform because most of my patients actually have cancer. But I do believe that if a patient has ThermaChoice and they then present with bleeding after not having a long period, like 3 years of no bleeding, then they should be evaluated by their physician to make sure that there's not an underlying pathology there. So before moving on to a second type of treatment, they need to make sure that they've ruled out a diagnosis of an underlying abnormality. So definitely this person should present to their physician and talk to them about that test, which is a simple office endometrial biopsy to evaluate the endometrial cavity.
So it would be an endometrial biopsy. And how accurate are those in terms of diagnosis?
They're actually very accurate.
Very accurate.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Dr. Mook, self-breast exams, can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Sure, absolutely. Self-breast exams can be challenging because the breast tissue is made up of fat and lumps, and it feels lumpy bumpy for most women. And so we recommend doing them once a month. For women who are menstruating, we recommend the week after their periods because that's a time when the breasts aren't quite as inflamed and a little bit easier time to do the exam. I think for most of my patients, the easiest time to do it is when they're in the shower and they're a little bit slippery and can run their hands just over their breast tissue. It's important to evaluate the whole area of the breast. So up under the armpit, up to their collarbones, and all around the breast tissue. And what they're feeling for is some kind of little pebble or pee, or sometimes feels like a pencil eraser. Frequently, if they push just straight down on the breast, it always feels like lots of lumps and bumps. And so changes are a big thing to look for. Something that's always there and has been there for years is probably not something that's going to cause a problem. But something new or different, any skin changes, any nipple all of a sudden becoming inverted when it wasn't beforehand, or any bleeding from the nipple, things like that are important changes to notice and discuss with your physician.
And would you recommend women going to their primary care physician or to a gynecologist when they notice a change in their breast exam?
Absolutely. And all women should be getting a breast exam by their physician yearly.
A yearly exam by their physician?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Walton, when you mentioned risk factors for osteoporosis, what are a few of those?
Some of the most common ones that we see are alcohol abuse, and that usually means more than 3 alcoholic beverages on a daily basis. Certain medications, and probably at the top of that list would be use of oral steroids that are sometimes a treatment for rheumatoid arthritis or other types of autoimmune diseases. Having an autoimmune disease such as rheumatoid arthritis also increases the risk of developing osteoporosis. Patients who have a family history of osteoporosis are more likely to develop it also.
When you mentioned family history, it's a disorder that's it's more common in Caucasian women as well as Asian women, correct?
That is correct. It's more common in women than men, and Caucasian women are at higher risk than African American women. Also, lighter framed and lower weight females are at higher risk as opposed to patients who are heavier.
No, we have a caller from the internet. Patients or the caller states her mother is 86 years old and takes prednisone, which depletes calcium from bones, as the question reads. Are there side effects from taking bone density drugs? So I guess we're getting into the treatment of osteoporosis.
So the most common medications that are used for treatment of osteoporosis, first off, would be daily supplementation of calcium and vitamin D. And we really don't have to have too many concerns about side effects with those medications. There are a couple of other broad categories of medicines. One would be the bisphosphonates, such as Actonel, alendronate would be the generic name for that. Also, you've probably seen advertised on TV for Prolia. It is a different drug class, as well as one called Forteo or teriparatide. In the first drugs mentioned, the bisphosphonates, they are generally well tolerated. Sometimes patients will have GI upset, heartburn, or stomach irritation, and that can be avoided by using the IV form of those medications. There are also other potential side effects, including osteonecrosis of the jaw, as well as atypical femur fractures. Both of these situations have been associated with long-term use of bisphosphonates, although they are not directly linked. And the percentage of patients developing these complications are very, very low. And what I usually tell patients is we discuss those potential side effects, but the risk of having a fracture from osteoporosis is way higher than someone having one of these rare complications in the medication.
And so in an individual who is at high risk for osteoporosis and a compression fracture, is there anything they can do preventively? Let's say we have a mother or grandmother and they do have a small frame and they happen to be Caucasian or Asian. They haven't actually developed any fractures yet. Maybe they have bone density changes that are osteopenic versus maybe osteoporotic. Is there anything they can do to prevent the progression of osteoporosis?
So, of course, having routine bone density tests is very important, because prevention and early detection is so key to treating this disease. And those should be yearly to every 2 years, depending on the risk factors that the patient has. Adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D is very important. For patients 50 years and older, they should have approximately 800 international units of vitamin D daily, and that can be either D2 or D3. And calcium, either 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium daily. And that includes what is taken from the diet. However, most Americans don't receive adequate calcium and vitamin D through the diet. They should also be checked for vitamin D deficiency, which is very high. So that would be a blood test that was done in the physician's office. Light or weight-bearing exercise can also be helpful in maintaining good posture and mobility and preventing falls. And there is some data that suggests that adequate vitamin D intake is actually key for fall prevention. So those are the main things that patients can do to prevent development of osteoporosis.
And how does sunlight play in terms of vitamin D?
So adequate sun exposure is very important for the metabolism of vitamin D, and the combination of calcium and vitamin D is key in maintaining healthy bone, because some people just think of bone as sort of a chalky substance that once it's there, but in fact it's a very dynamic structure with blood vessels and nerves, and it's constantly changing and remodeling itself. So calcium and vitamin D being adequate is needed for remodeling bone.
So would you recommend that patients who are doing light weight-bearing exercise, should they progress over time as their risk increases, or should they maintain a steady level of exercise?
I would usually recommend a steady level of exercise. In patients who have osteoporosis, we want them to avoid twisting or extreme bending motions and avoid heavy weightlifting, because that could actually create a compression fracture in the spine, or as well as a fracture in the hip.
Okay, very good. In terms of breast cancer surveillance, I know you recommended a mammogram. And when a patient has an abnormal mammogram, what should they expect at that point? Dr. Mook.
So the first mammogram that a patient gets is considered a screening mammogram. And that's where a patient's not having any trouble. It's just that that time for them to get their yearly mammogram. They come in and they take two views of each breast. And so if something is seen, remember this is a 2D picture of a 3D structure. And so if something's seen, frequently we call that an abnormal mammogram, but we just need more pictures. And so we bring them in for what's called a diagnostic mammogram, where they really zoom in on that area that they couldn't tell from the screening mammogram. And they take more pictures and do more compression views to see, is it just a phenomena of the breast tissue stacking on top of each other, creating a shadow, or is it truly something there in the breast tissue? And so at that point, if it's truly something there in the breast tissue, depending on how suspicious it looks, the patient may be recommended for a biopsy.
And what does a biopsy entail?
So it depends on how you can see the abnormality. If it's only seen on mammogram, then it's what's called a stereotactic needle biopsy, which is done in a mammogram-type setting where the patient's awake. It's done in the office. The patient's numbed up, and then it's just a needle biopsy. If it can be seen on ultrasound, it's still a needle biopsy and is done in the office, and it's very similar. It's just you use the ultrasound machine instead of the mammogram to localize the lesion.
And how accurate are biopsies in general?
They're very accurate. There is several results you can get. You can get benign results that are nothing to worry about. You can get a level of atypia, meaning the cells are abnormal looking, or you could get a cancer diagnosis. And anything from an atypia to cancer diagnosis is going to be followed up with some type of surgery, usually to remove the entire area. Even with the benign diagnoses, we leave a small marker after we do a biopsy that can be seen on future mammograms, and we always follow that up with a follow-up mammogram, usually 6 months after the biopsy, to confirm that the entire area that we were seeing before has been sampled adequately, or that it's gone and not changing and not causing any more suspicion.
You know, you mentioned atypia in cells, and this is something that we also see in the pap smear, or the surveillance for cervical cancer. What does that mean in the context of a pap smear, Dr. Black?
Well, basically, when we perform a pap smear, we're taking the cells that have exfoliated or fallen off of the cervix, and we look at them under a glass slide. The cytopathologist will look at these results. And what they're doing is they're looking at the individual cells to see how abnormal they are, and then they grade the abnormality as mildly abnormal versus moderate and then highly abnormal. And this is really it's between 1 and 3. We usually give it a number. And then after the third level is where you actually will see an invasive cancer. And we do sometimes see cancer cells even on a pap smear. But like the screening mammography, a pap smear is really for the patient that does not have a gross lesion on their cervix. It's for the asymptomatic patient where there's really no problem. They're just going in for their annual pap smear. And when the physician performs that pap smear, if they do see a tumor on the cervix, when they perform the exam and they see a tumor, they don't do a pap smear. They actually do a biopsy. So the pap smear is really for that patient that has a completely normal-looking cervix, and we're trying to find atypia or precancerous lesions. It's really to detect an abnormality before it develops into cancer and when it's treatable in a precancerous stage.
In a precancerous stage, how accurate is a biopsy in that context, and how likely is it the patient will get a cure?
Well, in the precancerous stage, it's very likely that they'll get a cure, and the biopsy is very accurate. We do what's called a colposcopy, and this allows us to really direct the biopsy. And when we do this colposcopy, basically we're looking through a colposcope, which is, it allows us to magnify the cervix and to really see if there's any vascular abnormalities, if there's any abnormal features on the cervix, that we receive training and looking for those features. And then we direct the biopsy to the area that looks suspicious. And that's very accurate, and in the hands of a trained OBGYN. And once you've performed the biopsy, then you can counsel the patient as to how abnormal. Is this mild, moderate, or severe? In the case of a mild abnormality, many times we watch that. Usually that's what we do, because this will regress most of the time without any intervention. When you have a moderate to severe level, we will usually recommend treatment. And that treatment varies depending on the patient and their desire for fertility. But this consists sometimes of a laser treatment, of what we call cryotherapy, where we freeze the cervix. We also have procedures called a cold knife cone, where we take a cone-shaped biopsy to remove it, or a LEAP procedure, where we also remove a segment of the cervix. This can be done in the clinic.
And we talk about cervical cancer basically being a sexually transmitted disease, the human papillomavirus.
Yes.
And now we know the vaccine is available for that. Can we talk a little bit about the vaccine?
Yeah, the vaccine is a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, it's underused. The human papilloma vaccine that you're referring to, it consists of four different strains of the HPV virus. Two of them are the ones most commonly seen with cervical cancer, and then two of them are most commonly seen with genital warts. And if a patient receives this vaccine, and this is for boys and girls, before the exposure to the virus, the studies have shown that it's 100% effective in preventing this cancer. So that's pretty strong data. Unfortunately, we see it not... Many patients aren't getting this vaccine, and the age that it's generally recommended is at the age of 11, which is very young, before exposure, and up to the age of 26. It consists of three different shots given over a six-month period, and this can be done with the pediatrician.
Yeah, so basically mothers should be having their girls.
And their boys. And their boys.
And their boys immunized for HPV at the age of 11.
Yes.
Okay, and is this recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics?
This is recommended by the American College of OBGYNs.
Okay.
And I'm not sure about the American College of Pediatricians statement on that.
Okay, so boys and girls age 11, HPV vaccine is recommended.
Yes.
Very good. We have a question over the internet. How long does it take cervical atypical cells to turn into cancer cells?
That's a great question. Actually, it's a very long latent period, which is nice. And that's why one of the reasons the recommendations have changed recently to spreading out the pap smears as not every year. We do an exam every year, but not necessarily always a pap smear every year, because it does take time. And depending on the study you look at, it's anywhere from 9 years to 14 years. So you do have a long latent period.
Another question related to cervical cancer, how much pain is involved in the LEAP procedure?
Well, the LEAP procedure is performed in the office, and the physician, when they perform this procedure, they do numb the cervix with a little local anesthetic. It is uncomfortable. Most patients describe cramping like strong menstrual type cramping. That's the most common complaint. But with adequate numbing, usually patient, it's very well tolerated.
Excellent. Dr. Mook, we're talking a little bit about causality with cervical cancer, and we know that there's a breast cancer gene that can be inherited. Can you talk a little bit about that and what women should do in terms of you know, requesting testing for that gene?
Sure, absolutely. It's a little bit complicated. We know of one gene that we've identified and can test for, and that's the BRCA or BRCA gene. There's actually two of them, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And this accounts for about 5 to 10% of breast cancer. But we know when we look at breast cancers that there's about 20% of the breast cancers we see that have something going on in the family. So we know that there's other genes out there we just haven't identified yet. But right now, the only test we have is for the BRCA1 or 2 gene. And that is something that we identify in families that have young breast cancer, so earlier than 50. You see it in multiple generations. It's also associated with ovarian cancer. The general population has a very low risk of ovarian cancer. And so if you see ovarian cancer mixed with breast cancer in a family, that is definitely an indication to get genetic testing. It's always better to test one of the family members that has the cancer so that you know if it's the BRCA gene that is causing these cancers in that family, because it's possible it's one of these genes we haven't identified yet.
And what does a patient do if they have this family history and they get genetic testing and they don't have any evidence of breast cancer?
And they're positive
and
for
they're
a mutation?
Positive for the gene.
So there's multiple options for that patient. We typically do increased surveillance for them, which means in addition to that annual mammogram, we add an annual MRI. MRI is a much more sensitive way of looking at the breast, but it has a lot of what we call false positives, meaning it's a little too good. It picks up things we don't really want to know about. So it's not good for everyone. But for those people who have a significant increased risk, we want to do that on them because if they are to get a breast cancer, we want to pick it up as early as possible. So that's one option. Chemo prevention is another option, taking tamoxifen, which is an anti-estrogen pill. That works well with the people who have BRCA2 mutations, but not necessarily with the ones who have BRCA1 mutations, because those don't typically have estrogen-positive cancers. But that can decrease their risk in half. And then what I do is surgical prevention, which would be a bilateral mastectomy, which can be done with reconstruction, and that decreases the risk of breast cancer down to 2%, down from what is usually 60 to 80% risk of breast cancer with a known mutation.
You know, we mentioned estrogen. You know, estrogen typically falls in a woman, and that's what's called menopause, when estrogen levels drop low. And if either of the three of you can speak about, what is the current status of hormone replacement therapy in menopause?
I suspect we all have different opinions about it because of our specialty.
Well, that's why I asked the question. Dr. Walton.
Well, as you commented on earlier, after menopause, when estrogen and hormones decrease in women, that's where we see a sharp decrease in bone density. So we know that the risk of osteoporosis goes up sharply after menopause. I see women who are on hormone replacement therapy, and I think that there are certain clinical situations where it's necessary, particularly in women who have severe hot flashes or symptoms that prevent them from living their daily life. My concern is when people or women are put on hormone replacement therapy and just left on it indefinitely. There are increased risk. Cardiovascular and stroke risk are definitely increased. So I think those risks have to be weighed against the clinical benefit. And in general, I think that they should be used very conservatively, and it should be consistently reevaluated between the patient and the physician to continue to monitor for those benefits.
Are there drugs besides estrogen that are effective for the symptoms of menopause?
One of the drugs, and I completely agree with her statement, there was a large study called the Women's Health Initiative, and before this study, we felt like hormone replacement therapy was just the most wonderful drug, and it took care of every side effect. But after the study, we realized there really were some side effects, mainly in the cardiovascular side effects. And so we do try to keep patients on it for the lowest dose possible for the shortest amount. And that mainly is for the side effects of hot flashes. And there are other drugs that we use. One of the drugs that I most commonly use, because many of my patients, cannot have hormone replacement therapy due to a personal history usually of estrogen-dependent cancer. So you don't want to give them estrogen because that theoretically could make the cancer come back or progress. And one of the drugs that I use is called Effexor, and it's an antidepressant, and it's used at a low dose. It can really be helpful for the side effects for hot flashes.
So it's a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. So it's a drug that actually works on probably some of the central symptoms of estrogen dependency. As always, we invite you to join our discussion. We'll take your questions at 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our guests tonight include Dr. Destin Black, surgical gynecological oncologist with University Health and the Willis-Knighton Health System, Dr. Julie Mook, breast cancer specialist with Breast Specialists of Shreveport, and Dr. Katie Walton, rheumatologist with the Highland Clinic. Again, join us with our Health Matters discussion tonight. The number here is 1-800-552-8502, or you can contact us via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Mook, we were talking a little bit about breast cancer and genetic testing and a positive family history. What are some of the other risk factors for breast cancer?
So the two biggest risk factors are number one being female and number two aging. And, you know, there's not much we can do about that. But keeping a normal weight, a normal healthy weight, just like what Dr. Walton was talking about earlier, heavy alcohol use can be a risk factor. Family history that we would discuss is another big one that plays into it. The hormone replacement can be a risk factor, but just like Dr. Black said in the Women's Health Initiative study, it showed that it depends on what kind of hormone replacement they had. For those women who are on a combined estrogen-progesterone combination, which is appropriate for women who have not had a hysterectomy, that definitely increases their risk of breast cancer. However, the studies show that if they're on an estrogen alone, which is the women that have had a hysterectomy, that doesn't have a significant risk to the breast cancer like the combined hormone replacement does. So that's another risk factor.
So you mentioned with and without a hysterectomy and hormone replacement therapy. Talk a little bit more about that. Why one hormone combination for one condition and a different hormone combination for another?
So this is definitely Dr. Black's specialty,
okay.
but mind you. Okay, perfect.
So patients that still have their uterus in place, the endometrial lining is very sensitive to the hormonal status of the patient. And when you still have the uterus, if you're going to receive estrogen, you need to counteract the estrogen with progesterone. And that's what we call combined, where you have both the estrogen and the progesterone. And so patients that if they only receive estrogen without the progesterone, that can cause the lining of the inside of the uterus to actually develop hyperplasia or actually develop cancer. So you really need to have the progesterone with the estrogen so you don't develop endometrial cancer.
Okay, very good. Dr. Walton, there's a drug in researching the topic, raloxifene or Evista, which mimics estrogen's beneficial effects on bone density in postmenopausal women. Without some of the risk associated with estrogen, I understand that hot flashes are a common side effect, but it may also reduce some of the types of breast cancer. Dr. Mook or Dr. Walton, have you heard of patients requesting this drug who may have a family history of osteoporosis or maybe a family history of breast cancer, and they want to look at possibly reducing the risk of breast cancer as well as treating their osteoporosis at the same time?
Absolutely. And this is one of the medications that we can use to decrease that risk. When we were talking about the chemo prevention earlier and the tamoxifen, this is another alternative. It's not quite as effective at preventing the breast cancer as it is as tamoxifen is, but it has a different side effect profile. And so it may be better for some patients than others. And so it's certainly something they can discuss with their physician.
Dr. Walton, is this drug as effective as some of the bisphosphonates or the other drugs that are used to treat osteoporosis?
It generally is not. We don't see, it does reduce the risk of vertebral fractures by about 30%, but it's not as good as preserving bone mineral density in the hip as some of the bisphosphonates are. For example, alendronate stabilizes the bone density in both the spine and the hip, and those are the areas that when you get a bone density that we focus on, because those are the areas that women are more likely to sustain a fracture or a break due to low bone mineral density.
And what's your approach in a patient who is developing decreasing bone density and they're already on an osteoporosis drug like a bisphosphonate?
So one of the first questions would be why they were started in the first place. Was it osteopenia with a high risk of fracture? And 10 years ago, we didn't really know what to do with patients who had osteopenia. And that's the low bone, it's a low bone mineral density, but not classifying as osteoporosis. So it's usually considered the stage before osteoporosis. And then a few years ago, a group of physicians compiled what's called a FRAX, and it's the Fracture Risk Assessment Tool. And this is a calculation that we can do on patients who are osteopenic and have not received treatment for osteopenia or osteoporosis. And it takes into consideration the age, whether or not they smoke, whether or not they drink alcohol, if they have rheumatoid arthritis or take medications like steroids that would decrease their bone density. So we put this all those figures in and it spits out a number. And this gives me the percent that they would sustain a fracture either in the hip or anywhere else in their body over the next 10 years. If that percent is high, then we consider them at high risk of fracture and would recommend treating as if they had osteoporosis. If that fracture risk assessment tool is a low percent, then we usually would just monitor them as osteopenia. If a patient has been receiving therapy for osteoporosis, we want to repeat the bone mineral the DEXA scan or bone density scan usually every 1 to 2 years. If there's been a change in therapy or they were losing bone density, we would recommend it at 1 year. But usually 2 years is adequate for getting a good idea of if the medications are stabilizing the loss. If one medication does not appear to be stabilizing the bone density, then we would consider changing therapy. Another thing that's very important is determining whether the patient's taking the medication, because most studies show that compliance with these drugs is very low. Most of the oral bisphosphonates are either weekly or monthly, and it's just difficult for patients to remember to take those medications. And the fact that osteoporosis doesn't hurt and patients usually don't have clinical symptoms, that makes it easier for them to kind of forget about it and therefore reducing the compliance of taking the medication.
So how many patients will actually have a fracture as their initial diagnosis of osteoporosis versus routine surveillance? In your practice, in your experience, how often do you see that?
How often do I see a patient present with fracture?
Who hasn't been diagnosed as osteoporotic, who has not, you know, undergone surveillance, undergone, you know, bone mineral density testing?
I would say I don't have an exact percent, but it's low, and I'm pretty aggressive about screening. Now, I do get quite a few referrals from orthopedic surgeons who have seen patients either for a hip fracture in the hospital, and then they refer to me for either screening for the initial bone density or for treatment. Sadly, the most recent study shows that only 23% of patients who actually sustain a hip fracture will ever be treated for osteoporosis. So basically, we're doing a pretty crummy job of detecting osteoporosis and then following up on treatment. And at some centers, some larger centers, they're actually developing teams of physicians that usually will have an endocrinologist, a rheumatologist, OBGYN, primary docs, and orthopedists who sort of work in conjunction with one another at early detection. If a patient comes in with fracture, then they are referred for follow-up and surveillance and treatment.
Yeah, that's very important. The patient develops a hip fracture, they end up in the hospital, they get the fracture repaired, and then leaving the hospital and getting that follow-up care is very, very important. Dr. Black, we have a question from the internet again. A caller has asked, repeated ovarian cysts, but the caller had side effects from birth control pills. What's the best medication to prevent these that may not have side effects from birth control pills?
Well, actually, ovarian cysts are normal. A normal menstruating female will develop a cyst monthly, and small cysts are not anything to be concerned about. Typically, when we see a patient that presents with a cyst, if it's less than 10 centimeters and it's simple appearing, meaning that there's no solid component, it's just fluid-filled, that's actually it's normal and okay. It's not an indication for a surgical evaluation. The best way to prevent the formation of cyst is to prevent ovulation. And when you start to take a birth control pill, which will help prevent you from ovulate, which will actually prevent you from ovulating, you won't develop new cysts, hopefully, but you can, it's important to know that this is not going to treat the cysts that have already occurred. It's not going to cause resolution of, say, a cyst that you already have. The most effective treatment, and you know, for the development of cysts, is actually the oral contraception, and there are several different formulations. And many times, people that can't tolerate one that has estrogen component, they can switch to a progesterone only type or a lower dose of the hormonal treatment.
And when should a patient undergo treatment for ovarian cysts?
Well, when a person has an ovarian cyst that has a solid component or has what we call a papillary excrescence, which is a sort of like a finger-like projection on the inside of the cyst that you would see on ultrasound imaging, these features are a lot more worrisome. And these patients, we typically perform surgery on to evaluate. Also, another test that we do is called a CA125, and that's a blood test. And it's not a perfect test. There are a lot of false positives, and often, many times, we have patients that have completely normal CA125 that actually will have ovarian cancer. So you really have to look at the entire picture. You have to look at the patient's age, look at their CA125, and then look at the characteristics of the cyst on imaging before you make the decision to perform a surgical procedure.
And what type of surgical procedure would that be? Would that be an open procedure, or would that be a laparoscopic procedure?
Well, it depends on the patient's body habitus, but it also depends on the features of the cyst itself. If it's a cyst that's a smaller cyst and you feel like you can do it without a large incision, then we will perform that either robotically or with a laparoscopic approach where you just have small incisions and you can remove the cyst. You can put it in a bag because you really don't want to rupture that cyst. And then you can elevate the edges of the bag through the skin and then drain it externally and then deliver it through a small incision. And that's a very well-tolerated procedure. These patients, it doesn't take very long to perform, usually about 30 minutes to an hour at most, and the patients go home the same day.
Very good. Very good. Dr. Walton, we were talking a little bit about osteoporosis, and a number of patients will have hospitalization when they have a fracture. What is the approach after the fracture heals from the standpoint of back support? We often have patients who leave the hospital and they're wearing some sort of a back support. Is that something that they should continue lifelong to prevent a further fracture, or should they eventually not use a back support? That's a question that seems to come up fairly frequently.
As far as statistics of preventing further fracture, I don't know if there are any hard and fast numbers. Generally, what I would recommend is a functional analysis that can be done by a physical therapist. And basically evaluating the gait of the patient, because generally a lot of these patients are elderly, so we want to make sure that they don't have or are not at high risk of falling, that their muscle tone is adequate and they are strong. And fall precautions are something that should be addressed with the physician as well as the therapist. But as far as preventing further fracture, I don't think that there is any data to suggest that a back brace would be helpful. And in fact, you don't really want it to change the dynamics or the walking of the patient, and that might actually make them more off balance. And you really want to prevent fall, and that's something that I always discuss with patients. If you have throw rugs, get rid of them, making sure they have a well-lit path to the restroom at night. If they have pets in the house, be very cautious about the dogs or cats getting under their feet and causing a fall. You know, it's very common sense stuff, but once a patient sustains a fracture, they're at increased risk of subsequent fractures, and hip fractures do actually have increased risk of mortality and morbidity.
So other risk factors in terms of osteoporosis, obviously we talked about steroids, we talked about body habitus, ethnic background, Caucasian women as well as Asian women. Can we talk a little bit about smoking with osteoporosis as well as maybe cervical cancer, uterine cancer, and breast cancer? Does smoking elevate the risk of anything besides lung cancer in women? Because we mentioned at the top of the show, lung cancer is actually the number one cancer-related death, a cause of cancer-related deaths in women. So what role does cigarette smoking play?
Well, as far as osteoporosis, it definitely accelerates the loss of bone density and increasing the risk of osteoporosis, as well as patients who smoke are more likely to have rheumatoid arthritis, which again is a risk factor for osteoporosis.
From a breast cancer standpoint, smoking can increase the risk of breast cancer if it started at a young age. So if it's done more in the developing years, girls who start in their teenage years, that's much more of a risk factor for breast cancer. But one of the things where smoking is seriously associated with breast health is with fibrocystic disease. Women have a tremendous amount of breast pain, and the nicotine actually causes a large amount of increased pain with that. And so that's where it's associated with breast health.
And in terms of cervical cancer, cigarette smoking is absolutely associated with an increased risk of cervical cancer. It's the number one modifiable risk factor. You know, we do also see patients that are immunocompromised having a higher risk of cervical cancer, but just in the patients in the precancerous setting, just by quitting smoking, oftentimes you'll have regression of this precancerous lesion. So in this area, it's definitely been associated with higher risk.
Again, we invite you to join our discussion. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. You can also contact us via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. The topic is women's health. Our guests tonight include Dr. Destin Black, surgical gynecological oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center and University Health, Dr. Julie Mook, surgical breast specialist with Breast Care Specialist in Shreveport, and Dr. Katie Walton, a rheumatologist with the Highland Clinic. We were just talking about cigarette smoking and elevating the risk of cervical cancer as well as breast cancer if smoking starts at an early age. And we know adult smokers who have trouble quitting usually do start at an early age. Dr. Walton mentioned that women who smoke have a higher risk of osteoporotic fractures. So if a patient, Dr. Walton, stops smoking, how much does that decrease their risk for progression of their osteoporosis?
Again, I don't really know specific numbers, but as Dr. Black mentioned, that's one of the modifiable factors that does play a role not only in osteoporosis but overall health. So as far as saying exactly how much bone density, that's going to help with bone density, I can't give numbers, but it's one of the things that I always discuss with patients, because it's one of the best things that you can do preventing most types of cancers as well as preserving your bone health.
As an internal medicine physician, what do you see as some of the most effective ways that patients can stop smoking?
Some people can just quit cold turkey, but for the majority of patients, I think that it takes about 5 attempts attempts for smoking cessation to be successful. So I think it really depends on the patient. Sometimes nicotine patches or gum can be very useful. Chantix is one of the medications that is available, but certainly comes with potential risk. We've probably seen in the media some problems with depression and possible suicidal thoughts. So that really has to be weighed specifically in the patient, discussed with the physician. And then electronic cigarettes, I actually have a handful of patients who have been successful with those as well. I know there are some recent controversies with the vaporized cigarettes, and I don't know the details of that, but the electronic cigarettes have helped a few of my patients.
We have a caller that has submitted a question over the internet. The caller says that she has sciatic pain and wants to know what effective treatments are. In general, sciatic pain can be related to disc disease in the low back. The most effective treatment is usually anti-inflammatory drugs, maintaining mobility as much as possible. It tends to go away in a week or two if it becomes persistent. If it recurs frequently or if it's associated with numbness or tingling or weakness in the leg, you should see your primary care physician. It's commonly associated with a ruptured lumbar disc. An MRI will show that. Most people get better without surgery. Surgery can be effective, but generally it's reserved for patients who have a lot of pain that doesn't go away. Occasionally, stronger pain medications or injections of corticosteroids can be helpful. Dr. Walton, we mentioned corticosteroids as being a risk factor for the development of osteoporosis. At what doses and for how long does it start to affect bone mineral density?
Well, anything above 5 milligrams of glucocorticoid on a daily basis can increase the risk, and definitely above 7.5 milligrams. Anytime a patient is on steroids, it should be for the shortest possible time frame. You know, there's some disorders that steroids are a cornerstone of treatment, and they have to be used for long term. But again, every attempt should be made to decrease steroids to the lowest effective dose and for the shortest duration.
Should women who are on corticosteroids for rheumatologic conditions or other conditions that are steroid dependent, should they be on calcium and vitamin D?
Absolutely. Absolutely, they should. You know, we want to, number one, check a vitamin D level. That's, again, a blood test that can be done very easily in the clinic, and make sure that the vitamin D level, a normal range would be 30 or higher. Anyone who's deficient should be replaced, usually with a prescription dose of vitamin D. That's usually a large dose of vitamin D weekly for a couple of months, and then recheck the level to make sure it comes to normal range, and then an over-the-counter supplement is usually adequate at maintaining those. But of course, anybody who is on steroids should have adequate calcium, vitamin D. And then with the bone density test, it's also useful, again, if they're osteopenic or in that mid-range before osteoporosis, calculating the FRAC score to determine if they need more aggressive treatment.
Thank you very much. Again, we invite you to join the discussion. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. We have time for just one or two more calls. The number here is 1-800-552-8502, or you can answer via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Mook, breast implants are common in the United States. How accurate is a mammogram in the context of a woman who's had a breast implant?
So it can be a little challenging to get good pictures. Mammograms are still very accurate in women with implants, but it can be a little more challenging and uncomfortable for the woman because you have to get those implants out of the way to get a good view. Most implants, however, are put back behind the muscle, and so the breast tissue is on top of that. And so you still get a good view and get a good accurate mammogram most of the time.
When women undergo mammography, a number of women will state that, you know, it can be an uncomfortable test. Can you tell us a little bit about what a mammogram entails?
Sure. So it's typically a machine. Most women do it standing. Some do it. Some machines are set up to do it sitting. And it's two paddles, much like a table or a square that's on the bottom and on the top. And you take two views, and one of them is where the paddle is on the bottom and top of the breast, and they're put into compression so that that breast tissue is basically squished between the paddles so they can get a good view of the tissue. And that's one of the views. And then the other view is where the paddles are on the left and right side of the breast to get a view from the opposite direction to be able to look at the breast tissue that way, again in compression.
You know, Dr. Walton, you're a rheumatologist, and a number of rheumatologic conditions are more common in women than men, such as rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and fibromyalgia. So what symptoms would you look for in a woman who needs to see a rheumatologist, let's say, to be screened for a connective tissue disorder or an autoimmune disorder?
Well, frequently, specifically for fibromyalgia, patients will have overall pain, fatigue, difficulty sleeping. Again, more common in women, usually over the age of 40. And patients who, they don't sleep well, they wake up, don't feel rested, and generally fatigued. So those would be indications of fibromyalgia, which is not technically an autoimmune disease. Now, specifically for autoimmune disease, such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, we look for, in lupus, patients who have hair loss, where distinct patches of hair have been missing, sores in the mouth that are usually painless, skin rash that usually occurs on the face, muscle weakness, so difficulty rising from a seated position or raising your arms over your head. Those are some of the clinical signs and symptoms. And of course, if there's a strong family history of autoimmune disease, mom had lupus or mom had rheumatoid arthritis, and the patient's developing any questionable symptoms, arthritis or swelling in the joints would be another symptom that should raise suspicion and would warrant evaluation.
One last call. The caller wants to know, what is the most effective medication for osteoporosis, or a medication that can stop it?
Well, it really depends on which area is affected. So for spine, when we look for osteoporosis, we look at the hip and the spine. Oral bisphosphonates, alendronate, and Boniva will stabilize bone density in the hip and the spine. Some of the other oral bisphosphonates don't target both of those areas. If spine is the main area that's affected, Forteo or teriparatide, which is a daily injection, is very, very useful in building back bone density in the spine. So if someone came in with a compression fracture in the spine, that would be a medication I would consider as a first line for that patient. It's an anabolic drug, and it's the only anabolic category drug for osteoporosis, and it actually builds back bone pretty aggressively in the spine. So I really would base that on the specific patient, but oral bisphosphonates, Prolia, and teriparatide or Forteo are the ones that do the best job.
Okay, thank you very much. As always, we thank our guest tonight for joining us here on Health Matters on Red River Radio. We'd like to thank Dr. Destin Black with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center and University Health. Thanks to Dr. Katie Walton, a rheumatologist with the Highland Clinic. And thanks to Dr. Julie Mook, surgical breast specialist with Breast Specialist of Shreveport. I'd like to remind you that Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance was provided by Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.